Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is new visions for climate justice. 2 years ago this week, an explosion at the Chevron refinery in Richmond sent 15,000 people to the hospital with respiratory complaints, the latest in a long line of accidents and health issues that's helped make Richmond a hotspot for national environmental justice organizing. Tonight, we're speaking with the leaders of key Bay Area organizations working to create a just transition from fossil fuels towards sustainable local economies, healthy jobs, and community democracy. Can we have power without pollution? What does it mean to confront the Bay Area's energy needs in a time of climate crisis? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues and more are Gopal Dianenne. Gopal is a collective member of Movement Generation's Justice and Ecology Project. Movement Generation works to address the root causes of ecological erosion and social justice through training, campaigns, alliances, and action. He is an educator and board member of the Rucka Society and the Center for Story-Based Strategy. Welcome, Gopal.
Thank you for having me.
Vivian Huang is a campaign and organizing director at Asian Pacific Environmental Network, which is dedicated to building collective power in Asian American communities to advance environmental and social justice. She spent a decade advocating for policy, legislation, and budget funding for immigrants, communities of color, and migrant farm workers at organizations including Asian Americans for Civil Rights and Equality and the California Primary Care Association. Welcome, Vivian.
Thank you.
And joining us shortly on his way is Andre Soto, an organizer for Communities for a Better Environment and founding member of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Andres is a longtime social justice advocate who has engaged in struggles for civil rights, educational rights, immigrant rights, and environmental justice for more than 30 years. He currently hosts Public Affairs on KPFA, and we hope to have him join us shortly. Later in the show, we'll invite you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation. You can email us your questions right now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Or you can post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Now, let's start with this term, climate justice. I'd like to hear each of you define it and what it means to you. Let's start with you, Vivian.
Yes, I think with climate justice, what I really appreciate about the term is that a lot of times when people think about climate and climate change, they're really thinking about what's happening in our atmosphere, what's happening to the weather patterns. But climate justice really wants to address, like, what is happening to the people? Like, how can we make sure that we're creating an economic system, a societal system that's actually equitable and just for people? And that actually is what's going to address a lot of our climate crisis.
Gopal?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think for us, the simple answer is the same thing that causes poverty, the same thing that causes pollution, the same thing that gives people crappy voting machines, and the same thing that gives people unhealthy food is the same thing that's screwing up the atmosphere. And you can't deal with one without dealing with the other. So the mainstream of the climate movement has tended to focus on atmospheric concentrations of CO2. And the climate justice movement has focused on healthy communities, right livelihoods, a return to right relationship with ecosystems and the places where we live. And so that's very, very much the center of gravity in the climate movement in the global south. And communities like folks in Richmond, where Andreas and Vivian work, are really bringing that politic and that vision and that kind of organizing to the U.S.
And we'll talk a lot more about Richmond shortly, but we are now joined also by Andres Soto of Communities for a Better Environment. Andres, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having us.
You're just in time to answer, what is your definition of climate justice?
Well, I would just amplify what Gopal and Vivian said. The primary key is justice. And if we look at justice, whether it's social justice, economic justice, environmental justice, they're all dealing with the structural oppression of people, and it plays out in all facets of our life. And so you know, in dealing with the climate, it's like Gopal said, you can't really divorce it from all the other forms of justice, because it's really a way of reversing the issue of injustice. The climate injustice, though, is somewhat unique in the sense that there's no escaping it. No matter how much money you have and how much you try to protect yourself, there's really no escaping it, because once you're dealing with the climate, you're talking about a global scale. And, I mean, we can see extreme examples of, say, poverty and affluence by seeing the high-rises and favelas right next to each other in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. But when you're talking about the climate, that impacts everybody. I mean, look what's going on. They had a tornado in Massachusetts yesterday or today. And, you know, that stuff just isn't supposed to happen. So, you know, that page has already been turned. So we're already dealing with climate injustice. What we now have to do is focus back on climate justice.
Now, we hear a lot about the term climate change. And, Gopal, I think you touched on this. But how is climate justice different from concern about the climate generally?
Well, I think it really does have to do with where we focus our attention, actually. You know, if our obsession is just, oh my goodness, we've got to get the carbon out of the atmosphere, there's all kinds of what we call, you know, false promises and false solutions out there to promote that, you know, to that claim to solve that problem by doing everything from putting little mirrors in the atmosphere to reflect light to ocean iron fertilization. There's techno fixes, or maybe we should buy and sell carbon and let people trade it. When you actually, and even the term climate change is sort of neutral. It's actually climate disruption. There is economic activity that is disrupting the atmosphere, and it's doing it by eroding ecosystems. And it's that economy that we need to put our attention into. When I say economy, I mean literally management of home. And so for climate justice, our real reference point is, how is this playing out on the ground in communities? So if you think of, you know, for example, in climate science, people talk about tipping points. We hear about tipping points all the time. If your perspective is from the sort of 30,000-foot atmospheric perspective, then your tipping point is like, oh my goodness, if we lose 20 or 30% of the Amazon, we'll have a climate tipping point. If you're an indigenous community in the Amazon, that very first bulldozer that takes that very first acre is a tipping point in your way of life. If you're only thinking about the atmosphere, then you're saying, oh my goodness, we're about to hit, you know, 450 parts per million or 420 parts per million, or, you know, or we have to get to 350 parts per million, which is all true. But if you're in a community, it's the smokestack that's causing the cancer and the asthma that is the point of intervention that will actually address the root of that problem. You shut down those polluting facilities, you deal with the climate, and you deal with community health.
Vivian, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to add, I mean, something very similar along the lines of, I think, from community perspective. You know, Chevron Refinery is one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters in the state. And I think that many of the members that we organize through APEN, they're obviously very concerned about the effect that those greenhouse gas emissions have on the climate and the atmosphere. But what they're more concerned about, in addition, is all the health impacts that come from the toxic air pollutants that sort of are co-pollutants with that, that comes from the refinery and the processing that happens there. And so I think for a lot of community members where they're facing a lot of environmental injustice already happening in their communities, I think that a way that really resonates with people is really talking about the climate justice part of the issue and really thinking about how can we remake our economic system, our societal systems, so that they are more just and fair.
Andres?
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, when we look at a community like Richmond, how do they get away with it? Well, part of it is they're also polluting our politics with the vast profits that they're making as a corporation, because it's a publicly traded corporation instead of a state-owned corporation that is run by and for the interests of the people, even though we've seen plenty of examples where that can be corrupted as well. But I think it's really, once again, looking at how do we shift the entire economic basis of production of material goods in our world, really, and how do we really do it in a way that has justice for everybody involved? Because the historic models, looking back at colonialism, was really about going out into the world and ripping off other people's stuff so that a few people could get wealthy and affluent and have fancy buildings and now fancy cars. And, you know, we have to be able to dismantle that and get back to a way where we can all live, because, you know, the reality is if we continue going this way, the impact of failing to address that is going to be cataclysmic for humans all around the planet, and not just humans, all the other species. I mean, we already see it in the oceans. We're going to be seeing it, you know, massive displacements of people. We're talking about kids at the border because of violence in their own country, because of politics. Well, you wait till you have millions of people running to the north because there's the south has gotten arid. I mean, the cataclysm that's going to result from this is really the thing we have to avoid if we want to save the planet. Because if we kill ourselves off, you know, the planet will heal itself. We just won't be there.
So as I mentioned in the opening, this week is the 2-year anniversary of the explosion at the Chevron refinery in Richmond. I'd love to get some sense of the history of Chevron in Richmond and then come up to date to what's happening right now and the activism happening. Who'd like to get? Okay, Andres, take the first shot. I know you're all very familiar with this territory. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up in Richmond all my life, and so Chevron preceded me before. It was originally Pacific Oil, established in 1902. The city of Richmond got incorporated in 1907. It was put there because rail lines went there, and they were bringing up crude from Bakersfield, which are still bringing crude out of Bakersfield. And eventually, it became Standard Oil of California, one of the Seven Sisters of Rockefeller. There's still the Rockefeller Lodge, which used to be a hunting lodge for the Rockefeller family, is now an event place in San Pablo. And eventually, it was involved with Kaiser in the war effort. Major fuel distribution, you know, to the Navy. There was the Point Mulati Naval Fuel Depot, which closed down, and we just stopped a casino project there a couple years back, another sort of social justice battle we've had in Richmond. But that just speaks to how big money in a small town has really impacted the politics, the economics, the culture. Historically, when it was Standard Oil California, before people were aware of the environment and the damage to the environment, they saw it as a big employer and everybody wanted to work there. And, you know, if you got a job there, you know, hey, you were set. Your family was set. They have the Rod and Gun Club out there, you know, where they got 3 swimming pools and a gym. And, you know, everybody thought it was really a good thing for the community. But when the environmental movement came along, we began to realize that the impact, not just on local health, because of the disproportionate rates of cancers, asthma, other autoimmune diseases as a result from the chemicals that are emitted by the refinery and other refineries nearby, that in the end, we had to do something about it, not just for our own health, but like Gopal was saying, we have really a responsibility to the broader Bay Area and in the world community, because it's, once again, thinking globally but acting locally. And so the battle with Chevron has taken on, when they became Chevron in the 1980s, then it became a different kind of battle because the politics, local government does have something to say about their operations. But when you got politicians who are being bought off by the corporation and does the corporation's bidding instead of the people's bidding, and they use devices like class, you know, division, racial division as ways to help destroy the community, where the community is fighting itself rather than focusing on the real problem, it becomes a difficult situation. And that's kind of been the legacy of Richmond. But in the last, 10, 15 years, particularly because of the rise of the progressive movement there, it's challenged Chevron. we had two ballot measures where people wanted to tax Chevron at a higher rate. And what we saw was Chevron's pushback is spending over $1 million, $1.5 million in a local city council race. They spend $2.5 million to lubricate Sacramento. They spend more than half that in Richmond to manipulate our local elections. So that's part of the legacy we're dealing with.
And what is the role of each of your organizations in what's happening in Richmond right now? Let's start with you, Vivian.
Sure. At Asian Pacific Environmental Network, we've been working in Richmond for almost 20 years, organizing the Laotian refugee community. And so many of our members, you know, were forced to flee Laos during all the wars in Southeast Asia and came over as refugees and settled in Richmond. And, you know, many of them, having been longtime residents of Richmond, have really lived through a whole series of different incidents that have happened at the refinery. So, for example, Sang Chanthanasek, one of our members, talks about how, you know, in 1993, when one of the explosions happened, how, you know, that's when she started developing this cough, and her kids also had respiratory illnesses, and how now we're looking at, you know, years later, and in 2012, there was another explosion, and how that a lot of those symptoms and those respiratory conditions really haven't gone away. We also know many of our other community members that, you know, have battled with or are struggling with cancer. Richmond is already a really a community that is facing such high rates of asthma, cancer, and like other respiratory illnesses, in large part because of the refinery and the pollution that comes from it. And I think building off what Andres just said, you know, in the stat that I always use is that in 1 hour, Chevron makes, you know, $3.3 million. So the hour that we're actually spending on the show, that's how much the corporation is going to make. But the health of our people is priceless, right? And that's something where, you know, our community members talk about the sadness and the suffering that's coming from, you know, all the funerals that they have to attend, seeing their family members and loved ones have to experience these health issues and health impacts when they're all things that could be preventable. You know, that we actually have the ways and means to be able to really limit the toxic pollutions and to really find new ways of renewable energy and locally community-controlled energy that is much healthier and much sustainable for our communities.
Gopal, are you working directly in Richmond with your organization?
Yeah, we actually, Movement Generation works closely with our partner organizations like APEN and CBE and many others in Richmond, and we're actually part of a national group called the Climate Justice Alliance, and we have the Our Power campaign, and that in Richmond is one of the key locations for that. So we do a lot of work with our partners in Richmond. In addition to sort of amplifying the impacts and really shining a spotlight on the crisis of the sort of extractive economy and the extreme energy economy that Chevron is really a pillar of, and the sort of stranglehold they try to have on the economy in Richmond, an important part of the work that we're all doing and an important part of the climate justice movement is not just fighting against what we don't like, but building an economy rooted in community for people that does right by the planet. It's as much for us about leading with that vision and really creating those opportunities as a new way of showing what we want. It's not enough to just be against things. You got to actually build what you want. And I think
so let's delve into that more, because I think that's a really important point. Instead of just saying no, this is wrong, you actually have a vision for the way you would like to see things. So can you spell that out for us?
Yeah, I'll start off with just a few of the things, and just using Richmond as an example. I mean, there's so much happening in the Bay Area right now, and Richmond is one of the key locations of that. It's not just a hot spot of toxic pollution. It's a hot spot of real solutions that communities need. There's a thriving local food system movement in Richmond in which they're short-chaining, meaning shortening the chain of exchanges in the food system and using it to build community resilience and community power. The Richmond Greenway is being transformed by organizations such as Urban Tilth into a edible greenway, and community folks are actually putting their own labor directly into building that out. There's a growing worker ownership movement. In fact, the city of Richmond has a relationship with the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain and are getting technical assistance and learning about how to build a cooperative economy. Richmond is one of the largest cities in the country, if not the largest city in the country, that's part of a community choice energy program. So taking the right to control.
We had a show about that earlier, several months ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
So your listeners will know. It's about taking back the right of the community to decide where our energy comes from and how we source it, and to actually build a local community driven energy system that's not based on massive utilities and coal-fired power plants or natural gas that comes from fracking, but local, clean, community-controlled energy. These are just a few of the examples in Richmond alone. And it's, you know, we are constantly hit. Chevron in particular is constantly hitting us with this idea that it's jobs or the environment. And really, that it's an either or. And there's a very simple solution, which is jobs for the environment. And not just jobs where you go and you work for a boss and your wealth is extracted by a corporation like Chevron, but actual work that you control in your community, that's meeting your community needs, that's putting resources back into the community. That's what we need. That's being built in places all over the country. And Richmond is really an epicenter of that, both in the Bay Area and in the country. And these guys know way more about it than I do.
Yeah. And we will get there. Let's take a quick station break. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing new visions for climate justice with my guests, Gopal Dianeni from Movement Generations Justice and Ecology Project, Vivian Huang from the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and Andres Soto from Communities for a Better Environment. We will open up the phone line shortly. For now, you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment on our website at kalw.org. And Andres, I know you wanted to respond to Gopal's point.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to hype up a little bit more about why Richmond is significant. Richmond has the highest per capita solar installation of any city in California right now.
I did not realize that. What is that attributed to?
It's really the 30 years of environmental justice work that's been done. CB's been there for 30 years. Groups like West County Toxics Coalition and other groups have been moving in this direction. But certainly when Gail McLaughlin from the Richmond Progressive Alliance got into office and started making it an official policy of the city, we have a solar panel assembly plant in what used to be an auto assembly plant built by Ford. So we have a wastewater treatment plant that's powered by a solar farm out there. And so these are the kind of things, and Gopal was talking about the Greenway. Well, the Greenway is converted rail line. That used to be the Santa Fe Railroad line that got taken out. And as he said, it's been now being converted into a park with, edible plants. There is a Laotian garden. There's an orchard. There's a berry farm. Different things like this, plus a lot of murals and art. So it's really integrating art to give a message that is portraying this more sustainable future that we're talking about.
And Vivian, what is your organization's vision of the future here?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to just add to what Gopal and Andres are talking about is I think the whole idea of looking at new ways of developing energy is it's not just about, though, the type of energy source and making sure that it's renewable, but it's also about who controls and who mm-hmm. owns the energy and who governs it. And so that's something that I know our community members have been very excited about, is thinking about how do we create these local sources of energy that would actually generate energy from the sun. But then how do we actually create processes so that community members actually have collective ownership and decision making over how that energy is distributed and provided for the community? And so I think that this concept that we're so excited about is really about rethinking like a whole way of how we actually relate to one another in community. And I think that's something that's a very fundamental shift a fundamental shift away from the current way that we're doing things.
And Richmond is really in the spotlight nationally. Mm-hmm. How did that come to be?
Well, I think it's kind of like what I was saying, is that this is a movement that's been building. It was around social justice issues, but the environmental justice issue just could not be ignored. And by bringing in, you know, organizing in the community politically, helps set the stage for people with more progressive agendas and not beholden to Chevron and the other Chamber of Commerce and the Council of Industries and groups like that that are still present, still active in Richmond, but came in with a different kind of point of view, began to actually implement policies. The whole thing about principal reduction to try to save people from the predatory practices of the banks and the real estate industry that have led to the massive foreclosures. We know that our community was targeted by the finance industry for the subprime loans. That's a result of the progressive movement in Richmond. The whole array of environmental justice issues we're talking about, the fact that we became part of MCE with this community choice aggregation was because people in office who were elected by people who wanted a different way of doing business said yes to this. And now we're starting to build out some of that infrastructure. Ironically, one of the big imports in the port of Richmond are automobiles coming from Korea and Japan into the port, and there's a massive, huge parking lot out there where they store the cars when they come off the ships. Well, guess what? MCE is working with the city of Richmond to turn that into a massive solar farm. It will be like shade covers, but it will be a massive solar farm feeding back into the grid in Richmond, which will help lower the rates for residents.
And what are some of the other things that are unique about Richmond right now that are bringing it to the fore in the national movement?
Well, I think one thing, you know, I've been thinking a lot about is just how much our leaders are really leading this movement, and how, you know, the community, the base that we're organizing in Richmond, you know, they're largely monolingual. You know, they speak Mien and Camus, which are two different languages from different ethnic groups from Laos, and how it's amazing that they. They're not at all, you know, afraid of speaking out, you know, despite some of the language barriers in an English-dominant society, and are actually really showing the rest of the community the way in terms of what the vision is for really turning what's happening right now with crude by rail and with the Chevron refinery project that's being proposed, but that there is a new way. There is an approach to actually creating something that's much more just, that's much more sustainable, and that's much more healthy for community members. And so I think that's also one thing that really distinguishes Richmond, is seeing that it's frontline community members who are really leading the fight and leading the struggle.
I think also for me, in all the years that I've been working with Richmond community members and Richmond-based organizations, I live in Oakland, and, you know, for one thing, the political borders that we're talking about are really arbitrary, and by that I don't mean random. There was an arbiter, and it wasn't the people, and it certainly wasn't the ecosystems. So the pollution that comes from the refinery and the damage that it does economically to a community also impacts the whole of the region, and also the whole of the world. And one of the things that I've always been impressed about with the organizing in Richmond is the ability to connect the issues in Richmond to communities all over the planet and all over the region. So, for example, next week when we're convening a national...
A great segue. That's where I was going next. So please continue.
A national convening of grassroots groups and allies working on this vision of just transition and this vision of, like, what does it take to actually transform the economy to address the root causes of the ecological crisis and the economic crisis that people experience. Richmond's the perfect place to bring all these folks together because, the folks who've been fighting Chevron in Richmond have been linking with folks throughout the region around everything from energy and climate action planning to stopping the expansion of other refineries, but linking with communities. For many years, I worked on Chevron's impacts in West Africa and Chevron's impacts in other parts of the world, and always seeing the connections between the struggles and using the opportunity of community organizing in Richmond to amplify the voices of other communities in other places. In the fight against the Chevron refinery expansion, which is they want to expand that refinery to take More heavy crude and tar sands from Alberta. There's always been the amplification of the voices of Indigenous communities whose land and livelihoods are being decimated by tar sands exploitation in Canada. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why Richmond is a really important epicenter for the movement.
Yeah, and last year our mayor, Gail McLaughlin, went to Ecuador at the invitation of Rafael Correa, the president, to go visit Lago Agrio, where the Chevron Texaco left behind massive pollution in the Amazon jungle that's led to international litigation. You know, and so we've also had last year, or earlier this year, we had Desmond Desa, who is a Goldman Award winner from South Africa, Durban, South Africa, where they're dealing with Chevron at the port of Durban. He came out to Richmond and visited our communities and making those kind of connections. And earlier this year, met up with people from the Maritime Union of Australia who are dealing with Chevron, who has a massive $100 billion project that they want to build out in the west, in the Indian Ocean west of Australia. So we're linking up, we're sharing information, sharing ideas, and it also is reinforcing, the real moral strength of the fact that, you know, we're on the right track. We're connecting with other people on that similar track, and it's really about the future of the planet. And if we work together, that's how we're going to win.
We will talk beyond Richmond about some of the other hotspots as well as the national movement in a moment. For now, let's take a station break. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing new visions for climate justice with my guests, Gopal Dianeni from Movement Generation, Vivian Huang from Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and Andre Soto from Communities for a Better Environment. Now we are going to open up our phone lines to hear from you, our listeners. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What do you think California should be investing its how do you think California should be investing its resources in energy? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. I'd like to learn more about the convening in Richmond, the Our Power convening happening next week. I assume you'll all be participating in it. Vivian, what can you tell me about that convening?
It's really exciting. The convening is bringing together individuals, community members on the front lines of fights against fossil fuel infrastructure and extreme energy production. And all the community members are coming together to fight for a just transition to the local living economy that we would all like to see that is fair and just for our community members. And so it's going to be very exciting to have people from all over the country, including some people from internationally, you know, from Africa and Brazil, coming together to share ideas and talk about lessons learned and really to strategize together about how to achieve this just transition. And then there's also going to be a huge action on Saturday that we hope that everyone from the Bay Area will turn out to really come and join us in highlighting the fights that we're waging against things like the Chevron's proposed refinery project, as well as crude by rail that's happening in Richmond. But then also to march with us towards a just transition. We're going to be having a community speak out that's going to highlight the solutions that different communities are doing all across the country to address extreme energy, and also a community festival that's going to actually demonstrate and show what different people are doing to achieve this just transition.
How many people are you all expecting?
We're expecting for the convening itself about 350 folks coming again from all over the country and from several places around the world. And the action, of course, we expect a lot more than that, and folks from the community and throughout the Bay Area. And you know, I'm really excited about the action on August 9th, and you can find out all about this stuff on our website, which is ourpowercampaign.org. that we're going to actually have an opportunity for people to do, to practice the kinds of real economy that we want. Like, we're going to be doing planting, and we're going to have a solar installed, and some rainwater installs, and different kinds of things that give people a feeling for the kind of world we want to live in and how we can do that together. And I just also want to say about the convening, the communities who are on the front lines of the problem, who are disproportionately impacted by the root causes, the impacts and of climate disruption, are also the communities who are driving the solutions. And so you have communities coming together who, at the same time that they are fighting coal mining or tar sands or crude by rail or refinery expansions, are also building powerful economic alternatives in their communities. We have folks coming from Jackson, Mississippi, who are in who have a project called Cooperation Jackson, where they're building a cooperative economy in Jackson, Mississippi, with the support of the local, with local government and a social, you know, social movement and community groups, that's really trying to rebuild the local economy in the Black South, but in a way that's in the hands of the people. And I think that that combining of both, you know, the solutions that we need that actually address the issues that people face in their daily lives in a way that that also says we do care about the bigger picture. It's all the bigger picture, but you know that we care about the world we live in and the environments that we depend on and the ecosystems upon which we depend. And you know, I just want to say that, like, people think that climate's one issue and the economy is another issue, and we have to. Many people think that when we say climate justice, we mean, oh, you know, we have to find solutions for the economic issues and solutions for the climate, and it's a win-win. And actually, it's the only way to win. When there is inequality in the economy, the environment's going to get screwed up. It means something is out of whack. And that's what we're really trying to demonstrate. A healthy economy means it's healthy for people and for the planet, not healthy for people who are accumulating huge amounts of profit.
Yeah, and another thing I'd like to highlight is that, you know, we're going to be, you know, in some respects, like a, any conference, there's going to be plenaries and workshops. But on the final day of the conference itself, we'll be having communities working together, sharing information, talking about solutions and strategies. But we don't forget what has happened. So on August 6th at 5 p.m., we're also going to have a memorial vigil to remember the August 6, 2012 toxic fire and explosion at Chevron. That'll be at the Richmond Civic Center Plaza. And, you know, when it happened, many of us were aware that was also, you know, Hiroshima Day, when the United States dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima. Well, you know, Chevron dropped a toxic bomb on Richmond that day, and a black mushroom cloud enveloped the city and the region. And so we want to remember that, and we want to instill that memory in future generations so that we will learn from their bad behavior as being a catalyst for change. And then similarly, you know, we're going to be also doing toxics tours. I'm going to lead a toxics tour around Richmond, showing both the issues of pollution, but also the resiliency and the changes in the community.
You proud to have your hometown hosting this national event?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely amazing, you know, that there is this recognition nationally and globally of what the work we've been doing in Richmond. Like I said, I've been there my whole life. And so to see these kind of changes in my lifetime where people are actually coming together to create this force and then use that information to help transform other parts of the world is just makes me Richmond proud.
Okay, let's let our listeners get in on this some. We have some emails. The first one is from Art in San Francisco, and Art writes, up and down the west coast of the U.S. and Canada, local communities are up against corporate pollution. For example, my brother lives in British Columbia in Canada, where one branch of the tar sands pipelines from Alberta is threatening to pollute North American west coast lands and seas. Environmentalists, First Peoples, who are Indigenous people, and conscientious Canadians are all working together against it. My question, what does your panel say about the potential for collaboration between local communities up and down the west coast and across the border between the U.S. and Canada?
Well, I think some of that's already happening. Right here in Richmond, we have Idle No More, led by Penny Opal Plant, who's a local indigenous leader who got inspired by the Idle No More movement of the First Nations people in Canada. And we've had a Connect the Dots healing walks that were once per month connecting Pittsburgh to Martinez, Martinez to Benicia, Benicia to Rodeo, and Rodeo to Richmond. We're also working with groups like Forest Ethics, who has action with those same groups that are mentioned there up in Canada, to stop those pipelines, because we know that the ultimate goal is to transport those tar sands to the coast, put them on ships, and then bring them down to the refineries all along the West Coast, as the listener was suggesting. So we understand that we are in connection with those people. We just want to help make those connections stronger.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, I think what's really exciting about the Art Power convening is that because it's bringing together people from the front lines all over the country, is that it's creating the space to be able to intentionally make some of those connections. So, for example, you know, I think about when I went to the Art Power convening in Black Mesa in Arizona last year, about how a big focus there was coal, because that's one of the big issues that the Navajo Nation is fighting there, and how it was so fascinating to see the connections between, you know, Navajo Nation and their struggles against the coal pollution of the coal industry, as well as folks working in Appalachia, you know, also fighting against coal, and then as well as activists in St. Louis, where the Peabody Corporation is headquartered, and so they were all connected around the same issue and able to strategize and build with each other. And so I think the Our Power convening represents an opportunity for us to do the same around big oil, and really looking at, you know, how does crude by rail link both like the communities that are sort of refinery towns, you know, that have refineries and processing oil, but with other communities that, you know, are happen to be along the railroad tracks that are also impacted by this infrastructure.
And the people fighting fracking, mm-hmm. whether it's in North Dakota or mm-hmm. or Pennsylvania. So all these issues are definitely interlinked. And so on the one hand, we can thank the corporations for helping us to see their, you know, their intersections, because that gives us the opportunity then to make those linkages with our communities.
Yeah, I would just add that the corporations don't have any trouble working across borders. I don't see any reason why we should either. And I would love to see, and I think many of us have worked on for many years, you know, a salmon nation strategy, an up and down the Pacific coast strategy, because I do think we are not going to rid our communities of the refinery pollution until we shut down the sources and support those communities who are shutting down those sources. And that means in those communities, we need to support their transition strategies in building their traditional livelihoods, in the case of indigenous communities that are and First Nation communities, but also building real economic alternatives that are in the hands of the people, that aren't at the whim of the corporations. The listener mentioned up and down the strategy, and one thing that is important is, what is our relationship to other parts of the state of California? The folks in Southern California, Communities for a Better Environment, has membership in both Southern California and in the Bay Area. And, you know, we're bringing folks from across the state as well as across the country so that we can have those kinds of strategy conversations and build beyond just the local fights.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing climate justice with Gopal Dianeni from Movement Generations Justice and Ecology Project, Vivian Huang from the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and Andres Soto from Communities for a Better Environment. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Let's go to another email that has come in. This is from Jane in Berkeley. Jane writes, today Chevron accepted a new EIR, which you guys can explain what that is, and doubled its community investment agreement to $60 million. Is there a history of Chevron funding effective career training, college tuition, and local green initiatives for real? And is there oversight?
Well, I would say no. What we've seen is co-optation and bribery is what it boils down to. And in fact, that deal is not yet done. Chevron did not accept the Planning Commission's the Planning Commission 2 weeks ago voted to adopt what's known as Alternative 11 within the EIR, not Chevron's preferred project, and they attached four conditions to it to help protect the health and safety of the community. Chevron immediately appealed that. There was a meeting last week, Tuesday, at the Richmond City Council meeting. Chevron brought in its employees and all the building trades unions who are hoping to get jobs because they signed a project labor agreement with Chevron in anticipation of the project. And we had 205 people sign up to speak. The meeting ended at 11:30 at speaker number 115. So that meeting is going to continue again tomorrow. So right now, over this last week and over the weekend, there's been a lot of wheeling and dealing, backdoor dealing going on. And we have yet to see what's going to come out. We know that we have two members of the City Council, Gail McLaughlin, our mayor, and Jovanka Beckles, who are on the side of the Planning Commission. But we have two people who are totally in the pocket of Chevron, Corky Bouzet and Nab Bates. So there's three council members at play in the middle, Tom Butt, J.L. Myrick, and Jim Rogers, the defrocked lawyer, people's lawyer from commercials a few years ago. And these guys are now in the midst of cutting their deals. And we'll see. Contra Costa Times came out with an editorial today saying, adopt the Planning Commission's recommendation about Alternative 11, but only accept two out of the four conditions. So that's just another example of the wheeling and dealing that's going on. What the council does, we don't know. You know, I'm not a betting person, so I'm not going to, you know, prognosticate. But I think that in the end, we will look at it and say we didn't get all that we wanted. And my understanding is some of the council members are actually holding out for closer to $190 million. But, you know, some of the people call that extortion. Others call it community benefits. It's who controls the money. And unfortunately, under the scheme that they're talking about, it would be the city and Chevron controlling that money. So once again, it'll go to their favored people, the people who stood behind them in this process trying to undermine the community's health and safety.
Okay, let's now go to the phones. We have Anne calling in from Berkeley. Anne, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks for taking my comment. I just want to make a comment that Andres and your other guests might expand on. I think it's important to be clear that the tar sands and shale oil boom that's driving expansion of the East Bay Refinery Corridor is not about the Bay Area's energy needs, and it's not about U.S. energy independence. It's about export and oil company profits, and the tar sands and shale oil boom cannot be sustained without lifting the ban on exporting crude oil produced in the United States.
I see a lot of nodding heads. Gopal, you want to take the first shot at that?
Yeah. You know, I think most people probably realize, even if they just take a moment to think about it, that all of the refining and all of the processing and all of the stuff that's happening is not about us. You know, it's not about, oh, we need all that gas for our cars. That's not actually what this is about. It's fundamentally about extraction, and not just the extraction of the resource from the ground, but the extraction of wealth from communities. It's how much money can you extract from a community, whether it's in the form of it, whether it's the community that hosts the refinery or whether it's the community that you're going to export the resource to. That's really fundamentally what this is about. And right now, the price for tar sands crude is ridiculously high. And the thing that makes it economically viable are two things. One is that we are rapidly approaching the point at which we will pay almost anything to maintain the lifestyle of, you know, and the, you know, the of the industrial economy, and they will do anything to shift resources into supporting that. So that's why we're getting gutting of public services all over the country in order to subsidize more of this kind of economy. But it's also about driving up the price per barrel as much as you can so it becomes competitive. You know, since the Iraq War, the price the price per barrel of oil is over $100. It's suddenly now competitive to do crazy things like deep water drill and tear up one of the lungs of the planet in the boreal forests of Alberta. It's because the price point is now being forced to a place where suddenly tar sands is economical. It's absolutely insane. And your caller's absolutely right. The big battle is going to be about exports, coal exports, crude exports, tar sands exports, all of it. There's this is not just and all of these communities and all of these organizations fully understand that this is not just about the local fight. And the way we talk about it all is this idea of translocal. It's not about we have to pick one big, big, big fight against one thing. What we need to do is link all of our struggles and all of these different places and have both a common know and a set of shared solutions that kind of help us advance past that.
Yeah, and, you know, Gopal is exactly right. And as the caller, and I'd like to thank Anne for calling, was that one of the things with this Chevron project is that they're trying to, and we think this is legally challengeable, is that they're trying to piecemeal out this massive hydrogen plant that is on Chevron land but is being leased by this other company, Praxair. And we know that they want to do this hydrogen for export because it's used in helping to take out sulfur out of crude oil so they can process it into other products. And we think that's particularly problematic because it requires so much more energy and itself leads to more emissions. And we think that that's a fatal flaw with this environmental impact report, that they didn't include that as part of it. So it's once again, you know, a sort of honesty within in the industry. And as Gopal was alluding to, here in California, gasoline consumption is down. We're one of the first states where people actually massively started moving towards electric vehicles. And so the demand for their product is less here, but they're looking, they're global corporations, so they're looking at global markets.
Okay, let's go to one more listener comment. We have a listener saying, there should be solar panels on every public building, the whole California system, all made by U.S. workers. Is this feasible?
I would say yes. I mean, you know, the challenge.
What would it take? What would it take?
Well, you know, part of the challenge is to develop solar panels requires a certain amount of technology and a certain amount of materials. Right now, the manufacturing of solar panels has been really led by China because of cheaper labor costs than over here. But there are assembly plants over here, like in Richmond, and if we were actually, as Gopal was alluding to, shifting our economic resources to intensify that kind of activity, we could put people to work doing that, and even more so put all kind of people to work installing them. And it's not just public buildings. It should also be private buildings. You know, frankly, one of our strategies with the Chevron project was to get Chevron to pay for a mass solar installation on the fence line communities of the refinery who have been suffering most from the pollution. And, you know, unfortunately, that's one of the things they want to discard, when in fact it would actually create more jobs than what Chevron's proposal is.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think that one of the exciting things we've seen in Richmond with the Community Choice Program is that that provides an opportunity for us to be installing solar in lots of public buildings, private buildings, and actually using that renewable energy to power, you know, the electricity grid for Richmond, the city, and other surrounding communities. And so I definitely think that that's the direction that we would like to see happen, is that we would be generating our own energy locally through renewable sources and finding ways that we could develop an economy that's, you know, about collective ownership and collective governance around the energy and being able to feed it so that the energy would go to power all the neighborhoods and communities collectively.
Yeah, I think it's totally feasible, and I think the first thing you need to do is, you know, give a nice big black eye to PG&E and actually put control over how we get and source our renewable energy back in the hands of the community. So one thing you need is some policy shift there. I could imagine really interesting local interventions. For example, what if we got municipalities to declare eminent domain over the aerial development rights of big box store real estate, of commercial real estate, all those flat roofs? and we declare eminent domain over the aerial development rights, use easements for the conduits, and go straight to the grid and put clean energy on all those private buildings to then resource the public buildings. We don't even, you know, there's all kinds of subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, both in and other industries that get massive subsidies, whether they're direct subsidies from the state or whether they're sort of tax breaks and benefits even locally. If you shift those subsidies towards towards community controlled energy with good union jobs that and where workers have both rights and control in the workplace, you could definitely do it, especially in the state of California. It would take significant public investment, but it is an investment that is absolutely worth making in terms of our long-term economic sustainability and in terms of community health and benefits and for dealing with climate. Without it, you're never going to hit your AB 32 target. You can cap and trade all you want. That's never going to get us where we need to be.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left, and I'd like to ask each of you, what is next for your organizations after next week's convention? What should we look for in the next year on the climate justice front? And let's start with you, Vivian.
Sure. Well, I think that I really love sort of the name of the convening, and I think it really symbolizes a lot of what we want to do. So when we're talking about our power, it's power in many senses of the word, right? And so it's really about reclaiming our energy, our work, and our democracy. And those are all fundamental components of our work moving forward. Is, you know, we really want to look at how do we build locally controlled and governed renewable energy systems? How do we really focus on the economy, you know, and providing job pathways for our immigrant community members to be part of that that new type of economy. And then democracy. How do we really involve our community members in the electoral organizing realm and to make sure that we are fighting for democratic processes in governance?
Go, Paul. 1 minute.
Yeah.
What's next?
So the conference and strategy session ends on Friday the 8th, and on Saturday the 9th, we have an action in Richmond. Starts at 9 a.m. at the Kinder Morgan Rail Yard. Everybody is welcome to come out to that. The conference is full.
How can listeners get involved? What's the best way for people to get connected?
They can go to ourpowercampaign.org, or they can go to any of the websites of our organizations that will get us there. I also want to say that in September is the U.N. A climate summit that Ban Ki-moon is hosting in New York, and there will be a large convergence of grassroots climate justice forces there saying that the solution is not going to come just from a bunch of heads of state getting together and talking about more ways to extract wealth from letting corporations extract wealth, but actual community solutions on the ground, and the New York groups are hosting that.
Andres, you get the last word. We have about a minute left. Can you tell us what is next for you?
Sure. In the short term, we need to deal with the Chevron project and upcoming elections in November, and we need as many people to volunteer from all over the Bay Area to help us go door-to-door on August the 24th, I believe it is, a Saturday. We're going to be having a mass door-to-door campaign going out to try to get Team Richmond elected and to stop Chevron's candidates from creeping back into office. But then down the road, we're going to continue doing what we're doing in terms of trying to build out the infrastructure of resilience. We want to see more of this solarization going on and other forms of local generated energy. And as Gopal was saying, we have a very nascent food justice movement that we want to see expand. We got a lot of vacant land and a lot of brownfields that need to be converted. And Richmond had an agricultural legacy until the industrialization of World War II. So, you know, that's something we want to reclaim.
That's City Visions for this evening. My guests tonight were Gopal Dianeni from Movement Generation, Vivian Huang from Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and Andre Soto from Communities for a Better Environment. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Zara Zimbardo. Join me again next Monday as we discuss how adverse childhood experience make adults sick. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.